Well, it is, Carol, thank you so much. It is such an honor for me to be here. You all have just one of the greatest association heads. I've known Carol and have worked with Carol for over 25 years now, 1985 when we first met. So it's just been phenomenal, and every year has been a joy. She has been just one of the most solid professional and highest integrity people I know in this town. So, Carol, my hat's off to you, and thanks to the association for your incredible leadership. It is a real treat to be with you here, and I will I'll try to shorten. I mean, Harry has done this great speech, which could keep you here until dark. Rather than do that, I think I'll hit on a few topics, and then I'm going to just throw it open to Q&A so we can get to maybe more of the things that are on your mind that you'd like to hear about rather than some thing. Because, look, you all read Fed Times. I know I'm talking to folks, and you listen to all of the things, and you're following the news pretty closely. So you're in tune and in touch pretty much with everything that you're hearing here. But let me just hit on a few points. In fact, let me just go in. Harry, I think it's going to be easier if I just go right into a few points. We are standing up the office. It's been a little slower than I'd like because we've had a hard time finding the superstar that I want to find to lead it. We've had a competition. We've gotten a number of candidates, and I've been interviewing them. If I don't find them in this round, I'm going to start over because I feel it's too important a slot to just fill. And so my commitment to you is I want to find somebody who I can be really proud of, that you can be proud of, and just like Carol, can be somebody who can be a real bridge builder and a defender of the interests of the senior executive. And so we're working on that pretty hard right now, and I hope to have some that office up and running and with good, strong leadership as soon as we can. Second up of primary interest with you is the President's Management Council. Jeff Zients, our Chief Performance Officer in the government, and I are working closely with Carol on a multitude of issues that focus on the senior executive. You all are our leaders in government. You are the core and the heartbeat. And if you're beating strongly, if you're well-trained, if you feel that you have the flexibility and the ability to be where your talents are and staying as current as you need to be, you're the pulse that keeps the government running. And so how you go, largely, the rest of the government goes. Because quite frankly, as you all know, politicals come and go. We come in, you have a little bit of influence, but the stability, the rudder of the ship of state is you. And what we have to do is to work with you in strong partnership to make sure we keep it free of barnacles, that we make sure that if it gets hit on a rock and it cracks, we can patch it. To do whatever necessary to make sure that that is a strong rudder that can help us survive and steer through any storm. And that's what you are about. You are the rudder for our government. And we need to invest in you. We need to empower you. We need to give you the tools you need to succeed. And so my commitment to you is working with Carol and with Jeff. My hope is we can come up with those in such a way that they can be refreshing your toolbox, giving you what you need, and updating anything else that we can do to help you be more effective as our senior leadership and our senior managers. I saw from the labor management, so I don't need to go into too much of that. I think you all are familiar with where we're going on hiring. What I've been looking at on some of these core topics is to get to the tap root, to try to find what is the, there's a lot of things you can do that affect things. And we all understand issues are always complicated and there's nuances, et cetera. But usually there's one or two deep areas. And if you can impact those deep areas, you can really sort of try to move the needle. And on hiring, when I looked at all of the things we needed to fix on hiring, and there are a lot, trust me, I know we have been, I think our hiring process has been an impediment, not an assistance to you, and so we're trying to fix that. But the one thing I saw that it just seemed nutty to me, and over my career of 25 years in the government, has been, why are we on this island all by ourselves, this island called KSA? And it just seemed odd to me that we are not availing ourselves of the billions, not millions, billions of dollars that the private sector spends on how to do assessments and how to judge talent, but they're all designed and built for resumes. And here we are in the federal government. We haven't been able to use any of that because we're on our own little island. Well, if we getting onto the resume system, my hope is after the initial transition, and we know that any transition, no matter what it is bumpy, and change is hard, and it is panicky, and there will be fits and starts. So moving from KSAs to resumes, I know there will be a period of time where clumps of hair will be missing across the federal government. But if we stick with this, it is my firm belief, this is the taproot to hiring. If we can get onto this system, it is going to free up, because we will now be able to access and make our avail of ourselves of these incredibly powerful tools that, like I say, people have spent millions and millions and billions of dollars developing that we can now begin to use because we'll be on the resume-based system. And so I think that's going to make a big difference in hiring. The other key things in hiring that we're trying to do, as you're familiar with, is one is hold managers accountable. HR people shouldn't be doing the hiring. Hiring managers need to be doing the hiring. The people who are in charge of the jobs, who are in oversight of the job, who know what the job's about, and how do they make that final call? They make it through interviews. And if they're not willing to make the time commitment to do interviews face-to-face, then it's never going to work. There is no magic system where just you can have an automated thing that's going to spit out a good candidate. I just spent 4 days this week with a panel of commissioners, White House fellows. We selected the White House fellows. We interviewed each and every one of them. And what's amazing to me is you see really sort of in a microcosm, looking on paper, looking at the resumes and the essay questions. These kids all had to write essay questions. They wrote these brilliant essays. These are people, I mean, like, my God, talk about the most overqualified, overachieving people you've ever met in your life. One guy had an engineering degree and a law degree, and he didn't have enough, so he went and got a medical degree. I mean, it's just this kind of stuff. You know, it's, oh, my God, they're just so smart. And you look at them on paper, and you're thinking, you know, every one of them is perfect. But then you actually sit down with them in an interview, and you really learn. Even though on paper, boy, they sure look good. You find out things in an interview, and you really get to know, and you were able to, and that's where the commission, we were able to take 35 people down to 10 to 15. So I'm not allowed to tell you the exact number because I'm not supposed to, until the president decides, we really don't know. But, you know, that gives you a sense of the fall off. Well, those interviews really allow you to do that. Well, that's what we've got to get our managers comfortable with doing, is getting and designing, and what we're trying to do is build as many tools as we can to get to take the headache part of hiring away from you and get you and the hiring manager into the interview booth, because that's where the rubber meets the road and where you can really find the right candidates and we can get the highest quality into the job. So we're going to be working on that with you. I think it's something we can do, we can nail. An interesting statistic, I'll give this to you as senior executives. We met with, Carol, you were there, right? When Harvard, we had that panel. They brought in all these CEOs from private sectors across the country. We had nonprofit leaders. We had academicians. But when we asked some of the executives about the hiring, and we said, you know, how much time do you spend on interviews in the day? 35 to 40%. They define that as one of the most important things of their job, and in terms of where they spend their time, the most important thing where they spend their time is on interviews, because they're deciding the shape and the future direction of the company with every hire. Now, if the private sector has that mentality, I guarantee if you go back and talk to your hiring managers, how much time are they spending on interviews? They're not going to tell you 30 to 40%. And if we're not going to sort of, we need to make that mind shift in the federal government. And you all need to be the ones to really help lead it. Because at the end of the day, like I say, it's the only way we can really judge talent. You know, you can do all the assessments you want. We can get you into a pool. But picking the right person and the right chemistry and to make sure that we've got the best shot is going to be through that mechanism. Now, the veterans program. Up and running. I think all of you've got it up and you've got your offices stood up. We've got, I think, 27 stood up across the government. It's going to be phenomenal. Where we're going with this now, in this year, what we've asked you all to do is just do better. Whatever you did last year, try to do better this year. So we had a pretty low bar metric this year. But later this month, we're going to be meeting with the commission that is chaired by Secretary Shinseki and Secretary Solis, and I'm the COO. And I'm going to be proposing to them a metric. For us to discuss and debate. And what we're looking at is essentially a three-tiered approach, whereby if you're an agency that is sort of, you know, if you're 15% or above, keep doing it and keep doing better to the extent you can. If you're in the mid-range, we're going to ask you to row a little harder. And if you're at the bottom, so we're going to look at this in sort of tiers. You're going to have three tiers. If you're in the lowest tier, we're going to set a goal for you that's really going to cause you to break a sweat. And we're going to hold you accountable because the president's going to look at how you're doing vis-a-vis that goal. And what we're going to talk about doing is applying this metric to next year so that nobody can have an excuse. In other words, we started the program kind of mid-year this year, so we didn't feel it was fair to sort of hold people accountable to a hard goal, or a focal point effort. Until we could get people up and running, get their offices organized and stuff. But next year, everybody's had plenty of warning, so we think this metric will work. We're going to be working to develop that at the next council meeting. So you know that that's coming. It's a direction the president holds very serious. I hold it personally very seriously, and I think we've just got to do better. With an unemployment rate approaching 30% for our returning men and women coming back from the Middle East, it is our moral responsibility to do better. And especially for our civilian agencies, we need to provide opportunity. And if you can do it, if we can do it in the federal government, what I'm going to be working on this year with the private sector is trying to develop the model. If we can get an indexable job database that we can share amongst federal agencies and the civilian agencies, I'm going to ask the private sector, Fortune 500, Fortune 200, and all the leaders, to come into this and plug into our system and try to create even more opportunity for our vets. And so you can see where we're going for this. We're trying to actually move the needle on that unemployment rate. And we're going to keep at it until we do. A couple other just quick things, and then we will make sure I've hit everything. We've talked a little bit about labor, so we may just go to questions here. Flexibility. And let me just hit on two quick things. Flexibility, and then we'll close with Fed Feed Family. Flexibility. We are doing a demonstration project at OPM that is based on the results-only work environment. You all have read a little bit about this. We are in the longest and hardest part of this is actually defining results between the employee and the manager. And doing that right. And so I think probably the most productive thing that's going to come out of this, I hope, is a real clear sense of what the expectation and what we are expecting in terms of the work product from the folks that are in this experiment. Something we should be doing throughout government, something we should do as managers, but we all know that it has not been the primary focus up till now. My hope is that if this is successful, it is going to allow us to be much more flexible on dealing with sort of what may be outdated ideas of the time clock and the workplace. And in the 21st century, my belief is that as we move into the 21st century, we're moving into an area of greater flexibility. We have this incredible technology. Let me just give you one example. I had a field office in Pittsburgh. We had 65 people working there. Almost 40 of them were regularly teleworking. We sat down with the remainder and said, You know, do you really, would you like to telework? Or no, they really liked an office setting. There's some people who will like that. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. We found an office space for the people who wanted to be in the office environment with another federal agency nearby. So nobody lost a job over this. Everybody else agreed to telework full time. We then terminated the lease, and guess what? Saved $270,000 a year on just the lease space. Now, that's a one little tiny operation. Imagine what the impact would be to the taxpayer and to our efficiency as a government if we move into a truly flexible workplace. Because if we've defined what we want as a manager, and if our employee clearly understands, and we can devise a way to hold accountability for both of us to ensure that that product is getting done, then what do we care where the work is getting done, and what do we care, you know, what time it's getting done and how it's getting done, as long as it's legal? So, you know, I think I'm wondering if, and I'm not saying they are, but here we are at the beginning of the 21st century, and I'm wondering, is the time clock and is the desk, are these 19th century anachronisms? And the notion that we have to somehow change someone to their desk in the morning and punch them in, and then they're going to work, and then we let them go at 5 o'clock or whenever. Is it time to move beyond that? And are we really getting the highest productivity? What Hennepin County found when they looked at this, and what Best Buy found when they did this in the private sector, is no, that is not the way to get the highest productivity. And when they actually challenge people to define what is it that we want done and hold them accountable and measure it, they had increases of 30 to 40% productivity. Imagine what would happen if the federal government could produce a 30 to 40% increase in productivity. The taxpayers will be ecstatic, and we can really make a dynamic impact on the society. So I'm a believer that this is going to be, who knows whether it'll work. We'll see. And as a way, because I didn't want to bias it, we've hired a third party. Deloitte has actually been selected to kind of be the auditor, an independent auditor. So come next spring, hopefully we're going to have a third-party report that we can give to you to say, did it work? Did it not? Where did it have problems? Where was it good? And it'll be by a third party so that it'll have some meaning and integrity with you as senior leadership. And then we can decide, all right, do these results justify going farther or not? And so you can see where we're looking at to play with this. And I think it's going to be critical. So I think that's important. Two things to come that we're working on right now that you will see more of it's sort of phase two of the hiring, and that is we are looking at how to make it easier for students to get into government, building on current programs and successes. And so there's a lot of work been going on about that, and there will be a lot more to come in the months ahead. So sort of next up in the batter's box, if you will, warming up, or screwing up my analogies here, maybe they're in the pitchers, warming up, is students. That will be next, as well as diversity. We've had a major team working across the government, over about 65 people. Chris Griffin, my deputy, has been leading this. They've been meeting regularly. Each of you have probably had representatives in the room. It's been phenomenal. They've been working very hard. My hope is that they sort of get to a place where sort of over the course of the summer, maybe in the early fall, we'll be able to create a program that we can take to the president to recommend. So we're looking at new ways that we can encourage diversity in the federal government, how we can do better there, the same way with students. So those are two things that are coming along. Last but not least, I'd ask your help on one thing, and then we'll throw it open to Q&A. The one time of year when we have sort of a supply and a demand problem in our local communities, and this plays out across the country, this was brought to my attention last year. And that is during the summertime, everybody's away and they're on vacation and they're not thinking about it. People who normally might contribute to their local food bank don't. And so the three toughest months of the year for food banks is June, July, and August. Well, that's the supply problem. The demand problem is the three toughest months of the year for people who are hungry or having a hard time in this tough economic time. All right, their kids are out of school, so they don't have the school lunch program now. So they're home. And so people who need help are going to their food banks looking for help. So June, July, and August, the people coming in asking for help are going up, and the supply is going down. And we have this sort of perfect storm of a problem. Well, here is a place where each of us are involved and engaged in our communities. And we can make a huge difference. Last year, across the country, people in the federal family donated 1 million pounds of food. And I can't tell you, wherever I go, and if I'm talking to a food bank, they come up to me and say, "We can't thank you enough because this was a lifeline for us. And it was critical to our communities." And God bless federal employees. That goodwill that inculcates will help us. It will help us on a lot of fronts. Not only will it make us feel good, but it will help us convey to people, to all Americans, that we are part of communities. And we appreciate our jobs. We understand they're good jobs. And we are grateful to have them. We are grateful to serve our nation. And we ask that our colleagues and our neighbors respect us for that service. And I will always be one sort of carrying that flag and trying to build the honorability and restore the dignity of federal service in the community. And I think you all have heard enough of my speeches that you get that I get that. But this is a critical way for us to show that we are big-hearted people and we care. And we understand these are tough times and we can make a huge difference. And so we've nudged it up a little. We're asking folks across the nation to see if we can raise 1.2 million pounds this year. And I think we can. And my hope is also, you know, look, summer's a little lighter time of year. People dress down. They are thinking about vacation or they just came back from vacation. Extend that Mai Tai feeling. And come up with some fun ideas that you can do with your employees. You know, be a little looser and encourage them. And like, come in casual, but remember to bring a box of food with you or an extra can or two. You know, do some things that just to remind them, hey, we're doing the food drive. Here's something fun to sort of spark it. Have fun with it too, because I think, it shouldn't be about beating people over the head. It should be about having fun as well. So I ask for your help on that as senior leaders. If you can help us through the agencies to sort of drive this message and increase participation. Last year at OPM, we did two things which were a lot of fun. One, we had a competition amongst people in the building, the different units. We had who could build the longest snake of cans. And some of them, they were hysterical. And they would whine through the halls. One group had a really smart thing. They were on two floors, and so they filled up one of the elevators and took credit for, a lot more space. The other thing we did was we did a sculpture contest, and that was government-wide. And people were they were amazing seeing what people could do and design. But I encourage you, be creative with this. Have fun. And really try to help. But it is one where we can make a huge, huge difference in our communities, especially here in the Washington, D.C. area, but all across the country. I think with that, we'll just go right to questions because, I don't, as Carol said, I'm standing between you and the bar. So I don't want to, I've managed to keep all my fingers and toes, even working with wild animals in the National Zoo. So I don't want to lose them at this late date. So let's just go to Q&A. Why don't we throw it open?
John, do you have any predictions about snow closes next week?
wouldn't you love a little snow right now, I have to laugh. There are days where you come in and it's such a beautiful day, and I say, this authority is all backwards. Wouldn't it be nice to, give a day off today, or something, instead of the snow? Nobody minds coming to work in this, But it is about safety, and this, I'm just joking. But we'll try to do that good. Yes, sir.
I have personal observation that the number of applicants for each SES position seems to be dropping. I don't know if you have any data on that, but I'm also wondering if there's any connection with the declining gap between if you were 15 salary and SES salary. Are you looking at that at all?
I am keenly aware of it. I think it is a huge difficulty for us. It's a challenge for us to deal with. There is an overlap because, you know, the senior executive service doesn't get the annual COLA. And so what's going to happen if you have one group that doesn't get a COLA and another that does, it's only a matter of time before they're going to lap each other. And so what has happened is that's what's happened is the GS has now lapped the SES. And so I think the GS, I forget, it's like a GS 15 step 10 now, you know, it's 9 or 10. I'm not sure which one it is. But it is more than, you know, the starting in the SES. So there's no incentive to move into the SES ranks. And so we're going to have to wrestle with this problem and deal with some separation at some point. My hope is look, everyone is aware of this. Capitol Hill is aware of this. OMB is aware of this. We're aware of this. My hope is as we work with this broader issue of issues with the senior executives, as we put together a package, that my hope is that can be one piece of it, that can be a component that can address that. Because over time, that is going to dramatically affect recruitment. And the data is starting because this is, you know, relatively recent phenomenon, but you know, there are indications, not enough that I would be willing to stand on and say, oh, you know, it's a disaster yet, but it is one that we need to wrestle with. And so I'm aware of it as an issue. I know Carol is aware of it as an issue. She raises it with me regularly. And it is one that I think through this forum that we're working on now with the President's Management Council on other SES issues of reform that we can do, that we'll see if we can put that into the mix. That being said, we all know it's tough economic times. And, you know, you heard Director Orszag talk about, you know, budget reductions in the 2012 budget, in an attempt to control the deficit growth. So, you know, whatever we do, we recognize, you know, there are these impacts. We're going to have to wrestle with that. I don't have a magic answer yet. I don't have an offset to pay for it. And I think until we can sort of come up with, with good answers on that, it's going to be tough sailing for the time being. So we're going to have to, it's one, I don't have a wand to fix, but I'm aware of the problem. Okay? Yes. Right, and I deeply appreciate it. And one of the things we're working on now is we have, the course that I barely eked through in my master's degree was statistics. And so my friends who know me and know my prowess with numbers and math always used to laugh by saying, well, that's the deficit right there. We just get you off the Appropriations Committee. and put somebody in there. So I'd be the first to admit I'm not the best guy to argue, you know, statistical analysis and regression, all that other stuff. I have a lot of people who work for me who are brilliant at it. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics have a lot of people who work who are brilliant at it. And so what we have done is I have asked our statisticians, with BLS statisticians, with OMB statisticians, along with some neutral parties like the Administrative Conference of the United States, like the National Academy of Public Administration, to come together and see if we can rationally settle this. Because right now we have a little bit of, this is my formula, so everybody has their formula. So everybody's like, my formula's right, your formula's wrong. Well, it's like, look, if good people of goodwill come together and we really are genuine about this, we ought to be able to craft a formula that has credibility anywhere. and to settle this and not argue it based on, you know, one article in the paper or one story on Lou Dobbs or whatever we're going to do, is it ought to be based on a rational approach. And so we're bringing those people together and seeing if they can reach a common ground and figure out a way forward. You know, my challenge to them, to the ACUS and to NAP and others, is help work with us, BLS, OMB, and OPM, to build an approach that will have good credibility and integrity that can withstand any blow. And so we are taking that very seriously, because I think we do have a credibility problem right now. We've got to deal with this in a rational manner, and we're going to be going about that pretty strongly. Okay? Yep. Yes, and we're working hard on all of those fronts. I think, you know, look, our guard forces have, had longer deployments, I think, than ever before in history. They've just been amazing in how they've stepped up in their service to their country. The other things we're looking at is we're not just focused on the hiring. I've been trying to look at the veterans, the whole experience, and help, all of the pressures they face. So We've issued regulations on spousal employment. So when vets are overseas or if they're moved around, that we've tried to help and give some priority basis for family members who can compete for federal positions where they go. We've worked on sick leave for folks who come back because, you know, what, thank God for our medical corps, they're doing a phenomenal job. But what it means is more people who are suffering very serious traumatic wounds are now surviving that in previous conflicts would not have made it. And they're coming back and they're requiring extra care and extra transition. And so we've extended sick leave and allowed family members to use additional sick leave to care for a wounded vet or guard member who's returning. And so, you know, we're going to try everywhere I can to help, recognizing the sensitivity of this. And we're going to continue working wherever we can to help, because I understand the unique pressures and the burdens that are faced there, and anything we can do. The last thing we've done, which I think will make a big difference as well, on the civilian side of the house in areas of conflict, is it was used to be a big problem, is if you were a civilian, and it could be an SES, you could go over, you'd volunteer to serve your country by going to Afghanistan or Iraq, putting yourself in harm's way. Well, you'd get the hazard pay over there, but you'd lose your locality pay, so the end result was you got screwed, you got paid less. Well, it was like, why would we do that to people? That's nuts. Well, we were able to get, this has been a long-running battle amongst a lot of players, we got everybody to sit down, I've gotten state, I've gotten defense and OPM, we've worked out a solution to this so that people can keep their locality pay and have hazard pay added on top of that, and build in all the answers to this. We've got legislation now being requested on Capitol Hill that will allow us, and if it's passed, and I think it will be, that will allow us to finally reward civilians serving in those hazard areas by not cutting their pay. And so I think that's going to make a big difference. So I'm trying to be as sensitive as we can on all of these different angles. My advice to you is if you've got more ideas or thoughts, like, could you help us on this? Could you do this? Just get them to me, because we're always on the lookout for them. Okay? Now let's, Mr. Press. Steve, it's good to see you, but let me let the senior executives.
In fact, I have an important one for you, and it's probably the last one.
Okay. You know, I'm not aware of anything specific on that, Carolyn. I'm happy to look into it. I do know that it is tough budget times, and in tough budget times, people look everywhere. So that may be what's going on. I don't know of any concerted direction or effort yet. you know, aimed at any specific, you know, community or specific group. You know, so I'm happy to work with you on that and look into that further as we go along. But I just don't know of anything as of this point in time. One last one. You've been very patient. You've tried three times.
I'd like to take you back to the hiring. Mm-hmm. You've been very creative, and I applaud APM on everything they've done with regard to the application process for the Senior Executive Service. But I think you're stopping short of one key element here, and that is the end of the process. You acknowledge that the interview is incredibly important, and I would venture to say that agencies government-wide invest a great deal of time vetting their selections. Agency heads have the authority to make those selections until you get to the end of the process, and that's the beloved qualification for the user. I really would ask that you take a good hard look at this. I know the Senior Executives Association may not agree with me on this one, as maybe some others, but it's really an important part of this. It's a deterrent, and it's a huge resource. A lot of regions and resources have been devoted to a process that I think has seen its day is no longer value added to the selection process.
I think, you know, it's a great point. And I have heard pros and cons, obviously, to the Executive Resources Board, the final, or is it ERB or QRB? QRB that we do. You know, there's pros and cons on both sides. What I can tell you is this. I am not wedded to any specific approach as believing that, you know, it must be this. I do not have a this. What I have is an openness to consider and weigh the pros and the cons, and how do we balance this so that whatever we do ensures that we have the highest quality possible senior executives leading our government. And if there is a better way of doing it, I am very open to it. And so I've, in my conversation with Jeff Zients and others and the President's Management Council, I know one of the things on the agenda is, what do we do with QRB? Do we continue it? Do we revise it? Do we modify it? Do we do something entirely different? In my personal view, I'm open. And I'm willing to look at anything that works and will work well. And so, you know, I guess that's all I can tell you right now, because we're in the process of looking at these things. I have no preconceived, got to be this way. My only preconceived notion is we got to follow the merit principles, and that's my only given, and honor veterans' preference. So I start with relatively very few givens. I have two, and everything else I'm wide open as to what's the best way to do it. And so I challenge our leaders at OPM, my associate directors and others, is just because we've been doing it this way for 30 years doesn't mean it's the right way. And is there a better way? And so that's the spirit I'm trying to put in through OPM on every issue. So I would put this as an issue, and it should get the same treatment. Is it the best way? And if not, let's figure out what would be the best way and try to do it. Okay? Thank you all. You've been very generous. I appreciate it very much.